right, we'll get started here. We'll call a meeting to order the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Hertas. Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
All
right.
Representative Neuberger.
Sure.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Quam. Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler.
Here.
And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, a quorum being present, we'll ask for approval of the minutes, a motion for approve the minutes of April 8th. Representative O'Neill, would you like to move the minutes?
So moved.
All right, Representative O'Neill moves the minutes for April 8th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have four bills up today. Members, if you see, or in the audience, if you see people moving in and out or not many people at the table, as some of our members are triple booked with appearances and bills and other committee, and it's just a madhouse running back and forth. And so, and all the bills today, there won't be any votes taken. These will all be held over for possible inclusion. So we really don't need a lot of members, but so it should hopefully go smooth. The first bill up is House File 1776, Representative Pinto. I'll move your bill to be held over for possible inclusion. And if you've got any witnesses, you can either bring them up or call them up when you need them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first I've got a delete all amendment to the bill.
Right. Representative Pinto, you've got the DE1-2 amendment. The chair will move the DE1-2 amendment to get it the bill in the proper form the author would like it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Representative Pinto, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in 2014, the state, a law went into effect in the state called Safe Harbor that caused children who are under the age of 18 to not be able to be charged with prostitution, even if they're being exploited or prostituting, but instead it treats them as victims in need of services. I should note, by the way, that since this is my first time before public safety, I'm a freshman. We brought in some treats, and in honor of my guests, I brought in donuts. Hopefully you can enjoy those.
Thank you.
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cops love donuts.
Cops love donuts. They say everybody loves donuts. So, Mr. Chair, as part of that work, there's been a whole infrastructure put in place in the state to connect victims with services, and also a lot of training being done for law enforcement. There's a model protocol being developed, et cetera. In the course of that work, a gap has been identified, which is support for law enforcement to conduct these extremely time-consuming, complicated investigations of what turns out to be a crime that's a lot more common than I think that folks may have thought several years ago when our state started down this journey. So the bill in front of you appropriates some funds for grants to support those investigations and grants to support training, technical assistance, to make sure that the officers doing that work are as well prepared as possible. We're going to hear from some testifiers regarding this. Full disclosure, Mr. Chair, I'm a prosecutor with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I've actually been directing that training and protocol development work around the state under a prior appropriation, so have some personal experience with this. I've prosecuted a number of sex trafficking cases myself, and so I want to make sure that you're aware of that connection. And with that, I'll actually call up the first testifier is the Ramsey County Attorney, John Choi.
Welcome, Mr. Choi. If you want to give us your name and title and begin, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. And first of all, before I begin with some of my remarks about my support of this bill that's in front of you, the Delete All Amendment, I want to thank, first of all, Representative Pinto for taking the leadership at the legislature to bring this bill forward and to the attention of this committee, and also for the great work that he's done as an assistant Ramsey County Attorney on prosecuting some of these cases and helping us and develop and directing some of the statewide training efforts. But that effort was really something that the legislature in 2013 mandated. And Representative Cornish, I want to thank you for your leadership and standing up on the House floor to support this appropriation, because I really do believe that it's made a huge difference around training law enforcement, developing protocols from around the state. That work is still very much ongoing. But when I first started talking about this issue about human trafficking, sex trafficking in our state in Minnesota back in 2011, a lot of people from around the state didn't think that this was a problem. Today, things have dramatically changed, and a lot of that is because of a lot of the things that have changed within law enforcement, within prosecution, and as policymakers, you, the legislature, have to pass a safe harbor law saying that we should not be treating those under the age of 18 who are engaged or who are in this situation as criminals or as delinquents, but instead that their children need a protection, they're actually victims of crime. And we've come a really long way. And I also have some information about just in all of you, and especially you, Representative Corner, should take great pride in some of the change that's occurred with respect to holding the sellers of victims accountable. And if I don't know if there's a clerk here who could hand this out to the committee members, but this just shows the change with respect to the prosecution outcomes. Back in 2010, there were 17 charges with respect to sex trafficking, and today, at least the latest numbers in 2013, there were 72 of them. And so what has happened is that we are now much better at identifying these situations, because oftentimes these victims will not necessarily self-report that they're in the situation, but because of the victim-centered approach that's been developed by and furthered by many of the people here in the audience, the law enforcement officials, we are much better at investigating and identifying these situations. Our public policy has changed, it's matured, and public awareness about this problem has been enhanced greatly. But because of all of that, these situations are now being identified much more readily throughout the state. And this bill that Representative Pinto is bringing forward, I believe, will help create the or enhance the infrastructure that's already in place to respond to these so that we can actually support the work of the investigators and the prosecutors around the state who are trying to bring these cases forward. But these are very, very complicated cases. In fact, the amount of investigation that goes into some of these cases, it sometimes is equal to an homicide. And so there is a need, a great need, to invest in that infrastructure around agencies that are doing this type of investigation. They need the help, and this bill would also provide the opportunity to train some of the other agencies throughout the state in greater Minnesota who are starting to recognize this as a problem and want to do something about it. But this would allow for additional ways that we could further the work that's been really started by the legislature in 2013 when you said that we needed to have statewide protocols, we needed to invest in training for frontline professionals who encounter youth who might be sexually exploited to help investigators and prosecutors. So I am very much in support of this bill, and I want to again thank the legislature for your leadership, and this bill will go a long way in helping with respect to the needs that are out there. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Choi. I appreciate it. And Representative Pinto, other testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Timothy Duchesne from the Wade Park Police Department is the next testifier.
Welcome. If you give us your name and title, organization, and go ahead.
My name's Timothy Duchesne, investigator with the Wade Park Police Department. I'm also a member of the Central Minnesota Sex Trafficking Task Force. We are a part-time task force consisting of general investigators and school resource officers within six police departments in the St. Cloud metro area. We did not receive much training in sex trafficking prior to the Safe Harbor being established, and I attending the Brainerd Training Conference in October 2014. Within 2 months of the Safe Harbor Conference, our task force investigated six trafficking cases in the St. Cloud area. This included an investigation of a shooting that had occurred at a local hotel in Wade Park. During this investigation, a juvenile runaway from Hubbard County was located. I used the skills that I learned from this the Safe Harbor Training Conference to interview the runaway and identify that she was a victim of sex trafficking. With the help of other task force members, the Safe Harbor Initiative, West Central Minnesota Regional Navigator, the 16-year-old victim was rescued and given the help she needs. And an adult victim was also rescued in one of the other investigations. Three adult suspects were arrested and are being prosecuted in Stearns County. The investigations took 1,000 hours of investigative time to complete. Several search warrants were executed, administrative subpoenas served, interviews conducted, and cell phones extracted. These investigations were by far the most complex and difficult investigations that I had conducted within my 28-year law enforcement career. Most of the law enforcement agencies do not have the time or skill level to complete a proper sex trafficking investigation. Sex trafficking occurs throughout the state of Minnesota. With the passing of this bill, it will give law enforcement the tools needed to combat sex trafficking. Thank you for consideration.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, West St. Paul Police Chief Bud Shaver is the next testifier.
You bet.
And Mr. Chair, there are some cards being distributed that were prepared for training for officers at the same time. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bud Shaver. I'm the police chief of West St. Paul. I've been in law enforcement a little bit more than 30 years. You know, I kind of chuckle. I have a little calendar on my desk with whimsical phrases on it, and I just shared it with my finance director. It says, no matter what they're talking about money, and I think that's true here. Gangs, drugs, and sex trafficking are often found together. They are criminal enterprises, and it just makes sense to establish a coordinated effort in investigating these activities. Unlike drugs, once they are sold, they are gone. Gangs are increasingly discovering the profitability of possessing a reusable product, a person. Unfortunately, it's easy to see and understand the impact and harm of gang and drug crimes. Conversely, sex crimes and human trafficking occur behind closed doors. Simply put, sex trafficking targets and exploits women. Our most vulnerable victims, usually, are female youth struggling with numerous life and personal challenges. Unlike some of my colleagues behind me, I don't have any outlandish stories of sex trafficking in which to appeal to you to make these changes, but I do have a few brief stories of victimization that occur every day in all our communities, whether you see them or not. We're pretty busy in West St. Paul, and we had a call of a dispute, and I didn't have an officer to respond right away, so I responded. And it was really the stereotypical. It was a one-bedroom apartment with a mattress on the floor, a young lady there with a halter top and short shorts, and a gentleman and two other guys of interest, and no one wanted the police there. We tried to help her. She didn't want any help. She just wanted to get back to work. She was in fear for what these other individuals were doing. As such, we lost that victim. There was nothing that we could do for her. Recently, the feds came into our town and investigated one of our restaurants. We found a hotel room, a single-bed hotel room with 15 beds in it of human trafficking. Another incident, the last one I'll share with you, is probably more concerning. I know that Chief Paul Schnell in Maplewood and Eric Degasy in Burnsville have been having similar problems. But we've had these massage parlors come to town, and they're basically Chinese women. They're being exploited from their country. They flee here to America and get political asylum, and they're quickly put into these massage businesses. They are intimidated and exploited for years sometimes. And we've had these ladies come into our community, and we're trying to deal with them. We know what these massage parlors are doing, but investigating them is very hard. I've reached out for some federal help, and after a week, I got a return telephone call. Find a code violation and just get them out of your town. That works well, and we've all changed our ordinances to do something with these massage parlors, but these victims, these women, continually are exploited. As such, I commend Representative Dave Pinto and this community for taking action to address the shameful abuse and victimization. But the question is what do we do? Like most police and sheriff agencies, we're busy. Minnesotans have and continue to ask a lot from our officers. I have 15 patrol officers answering 22,000 police calls a year. On most days, we're stretched to the limit. It's impractical to ask a patrol officer to investigate a sex trafficking incident that is most likely a multi-state occurrence, one that requires search warrants of Facebook, Craigslist, and Backpage accounts to investigate a vanilla Visa card, the currency used in sex trafficking, or the other numerous tasks of a complex investigation. As such, our current situation favors the criminal. Officers are often overtasked and not coordinated. Resources are in short supply, and the victims we seek to help are abused and intimidated on a daily basis so they do not cooperate with the police. The passing of Safe Harbor Law in 2011 was an important first step. We still have a long ways to go. As legislators and committee members, you have an immense and difficult responsibility in deciding what takes priority. By very conservative measures, a November 2010 study found that each month in Minnesota, at least 213 girls are sold for sex an average five times a day through the internet and escort services. I hope that you keep in mind your daughters, your nieces, and even that young gal down the street when you decide what's important. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Do you remember Dwight Stewart?
Pardon?
Dwight Stewart?
Yes.
He was a former chief there, is it? Or what was?
In West St. Paul.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering. Just trying to track down.
Been around a while, but no, that name's not.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
With your permission, Mark Chatterton, who's a Nicollet County deputy.
Ernie. Mr. Chatterton is one of my cohorts back home here.
Ah,
so.
Okay.
Morning.
Welcome, sir. If you give your name and organization and to begin.
I'm Investigator Mark Chatterton with the Nicollet County Sheriff's Office, and I'm the president and founder of a nonprofit investigator group in southern Minnesota consisting of about 40 agencies and about 90 investigators. I attended a human trafficking safe harbor training in Brainerd, Minnesota in October of 2014, along with several other investigators from greater Minnesota. When we returned from the training, we started to look for exploitation and trafficking in our community. And what we found in the past 5 months is that we have a problem in greater Minnesota. We placed an ad in an online for prostitution on a Thursday beginning at 10:30 in the morning. Within a half hour, we started receiving calls, and I mean we got a lot of calls. We arrested five for prostitution and one for narcotics in a few hours. We then received a complaint of a 14-year-old girl who had been trafficked in Rice County, and she reported that her 9-year-old sister was being trafficked in my jurisdiction. We also encountered a number of girls who had been sexually exploited, receiving drugs in exchange for sex in southern Minnesota. Since this training, we've also received several tips from the VIC task force involving trafficking. This problem is not unique to my community or the metro area. Trafficking is a problem in our state. These cases are time and labor intensive. Many of our jurisdictions only have two investigators. We don't have VICE, and we have general investigators who do these investigations. We simply don't have the resources or tools to investigate them and give each case the time that they deserve. Please support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, the final testifier is Grant Snyder, who's a sergeant with Minneapolis Police Department.
Welcome, sir. If you give your name and organization. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sergeant Grant Snyder. I'm a detective with Minneapolis Police. I'm the lead investigator in our human trafficking initiative in that city. I've been doing this work a long time, and fortunately enough, a couple of years ago when we were looking at some of the new legislation with safe harbors, our really very initial goal was to really establish a basis of passion among state law enforcement. And I can tell you today, based on the testimony not only that you've heard, but from the voices that are heard around the state, you've got what you asked for. You have a group of police officers in the state and detectives that are impassioned to help the victims, that are very outraged over what these victims have endured, and they're ready to go to work. The challenge for many of us, and we're fortunate enough in Minneapolis to have full-time investigators who are able to focus on this, but the real challenge comes in, and you heard from various testifiers, certainly Chief Shaver from West St. Paul talked about their issue with resources and their issue with confronting the true complexity of these cases. How do you take an investigator who spreads so very thin and has no understanding necessarily or experience in dealing with one of these cases, and then you have to work with them to try and understand how to interpret and unravel social media, how to interpret a marketing plan, how to deal with the identification process of not just one, but sometimes up to a dozen victims, all of whom are in a very different place with regard to being able to even be accessible to law enforcement. Those are the phone calls that we receive. Those are the requests for service that we receive. I see this bill and this ability to extend out to the other investigators across the state as a force multiplier for us in law enforcement, to be able to take the experience that many of us have gleaned from working in this for years, full-time to be able to take that expertise and provide the information that we've got and share across the jurisdictions to glean what they've done well, what's worked for them in these other jurisdictions, how they're doing it. And it's just, I can't tell you how critical this sort of a structure is for us being able to combat these cases, because the traffickers, they don't see boundaries. That doesn't matter to them. And the victims don't see boundaries either. So thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Chair, there was another testifier who was available for comments. We won't have him testify in the interest of time. That's Anoka County Deputy Mike Shanzen. And obviously you're aware of, the committee can see the other officers here, any of whom would be very happy to testify. With that, I'll take comments. I have a couple final comments as well, but any questions?
Okay, any questions from the members yet? Okay, any comments or questions from the public? Representative Winkler, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, I just first want to say congratulations to you and to County Attorney Choi and all the law enforcement officers who are working on this. I think this is the, you know, I don't want to pick favorites, but I think this might be the best initiative in public safety and protection of vulnerable people in our state that we've had in a number of years. And I think this may be one of the best uses of $1 million in state appropriations I can think of. My question to you is, is $1 million enough to make the difference? Or could we do, in fact, more to support these efforts?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, thank you for your comments, of course, and for your question. The original version of the bill that you all looked at before coming in here contained a number of options for funding. And in the lead up to the committee meeting today, I met with folks from the chiefs of police and sheriffs and others and have talked about what a longer term plan for this would be. And the likely plan would be a parallel version of what we do about gangs and drugs. The first section of the original bill was had to do with the Violent Crime Coordinating Council and violent crime enforcement teams, and paralleling that. Representative Winkler, certainly the more money that goes into this, the better. Having said that, we want to make sure that we're very smart about it as well, and make sure. So I make a comparison with the amount of money that we invest as a state in fighting drugs. And drug trafficking, there is a massive infrastructure in place. We need, as a state, to get to the place of having that infrastructure. I would say at this point for this biennium, we probably are not ready to say that infrastructure is something that we know well enough to know we want to fund. So I would say, could we make even better use of $2 million than $1 million? Yes, and even more use of it than that. But I think many of us are viewing this coming biennium as, this is really a chance to kind of put our finger in the dike, right? To say, okay, this is, we have unleashed a kind of a beast, as Sergeant Snyder was alluding to. These cards that you all have, the red cards, are being handed out to every single police officer in the state, along with some roll call videos and a series of live trainings, including the conference that a number of the speakers alluded to just from last October. There will be a flood of these cases coming, most likely because of awareness being raised. And right now, the money needs to go in to get grants out around the state, and then over time we're going to think about what the infrastructure is to really respond. A very long answer to your question. Yes, we could use more money, and we want to make sure we're very smart about it as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, my only follow-up comment then, Mr. Representative Pinto, is, you know, we come back next year, and it would be a great time to come back with a longer-term vision.
And Mr. Chair, with your permission to respond to that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. And in fact, that is absolutely the plan. The chiefs and the sheriffs and the BCA and others, we plan to have conversations over this coming year, and you can expect that we'll be coming back with a well-thought-out plan, and hopefully you remember at that point my response to your question right now. Thank you.
Other questions from members? Representative, I guess we got a list. Howe and then Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Officer DeShane from traveling from Wake Park to come down here and testify, because that's a place I know rather well. And I think that's an indication to let people know that this isn't a big city problem. This is a state problem that we have to fight, and it hits all the little towns out there. And I really think that people don't understand how big a problem we have with this. So I commend you on this effort, and I thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, thank you. You're in the right place to take the lead on this, and I appreciate your work and the County Attorney's Office and all of the other officers who've worked on this. The time and the attention and the passion that you bring to this has really made a difference. So my question really is, you know, because of my background, prevention, and we've done a lot of work on helping kids know how to make choices about drugs, how to get help when they need some assistance. Is there any part of this bill or the plans for next year to do some more public education? The Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale program, you know, we hear on the radio, we hear that, and I think people are beginning to awaken to it, but they really don't understand the magnitude of the problem. It's a great slogan. I think it's moving in a really good direction, but is there any part of this that is about public education and helping in the prevention through schools or community work?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so glad that you would bring that up, Representative Ward. This bill is in fact a companion to a continuation of the Safe Harbor work, victim support and services. So that's one element there. I want to make sure to call out Representative Tim Miller, who's in the audience, who's a co-author in the bill, and I'm supporting his bill as well. It'll be up at 12:45. Have a hearing. All this work then, Representative Ward, really is driving towards moving back through the process towards prevention. There's some really exciting things going on. I think the first step is to help these girls in crisis, go after the people who are exploiting them. But I can tell you, everyone working on this issue is then moving back. And in fact, I should note I have a separate bill for sexual violence prevention, in fact, and we should talk, or other committee members are happy to talk about that as well. But I can assure you that that's embedded in all the work of Safe Harbor. I want to make sure to acknowledge the non-law enforcement component of this work that's advancing through the legislature right now, and ask members to be very supportive of that as well. That's a crucial companion piece to this bill. Thank you. And I heard somebody say my name in the... Representative Miller was going to give that answer. I want to make sure to call him out. Thank you, Representative.
Okay, comments from the public? Seeing none, any closing remarks?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I just want to also make sure to note this card was co-produced by the VIC Human Trafficking Task Force out of St. Paul Police Department, which is multi-jurisdictional. The director of that, Sergeant Ray Gainey, is in the audience as well. You can see all the support from around the state. The BCA has a request via the governor's budget to add agents to work on sex trafficking and on internet crimes against children as well. This is also a companion to that. We want to make sure to support that ask as well. I thank the members very much for your long-term support of this work. This really is the next step in our Safe Harbor movement to make sure that children are not being exploited in our state. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your support.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. With that, the chair will hold over for possible inclusion, House File 1776.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Now that that bill is over, so there's actually a provision in the statute that now that all the folks that actually practice in this area are in the room, that says that any of the finances that are seized or forfeited from these kinds of crime can go right into these victim services. So. Those of you that are practicing, that's currently law and might be useful.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Our next bill was Representative Norton, House File 1056. Thank you all for coming today. Representative Norton, I'll move your bill to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. House File 1056. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here today. We took a circuitous route to get here. We started in long-term care and went to GovOps and went through the healthcare committees and mistakenly ended up in healthcare finance. So I very much appreciate that we ended up in the right finance committee and that you're able to hear the bill today. What I have before you is a bill for a grant program. It's voluntary in nature, and it allows for law enforcement agencies to receive training and the cost for associated equipment needed to put in place a Project Lifesaver type opportunity for their populations at risk. And we started in long-term care because with our growing Alzheimer's population and growing aging population, of which some of us are included in that, we do know we'll have an increase in dementia and Alzheimer's, and while we try to provide the very best care we can, some folks are at risk for wandering off, not only in our elderly population, but also in our population of young and vulnerable children, including those with autism. So I have a constituent with me today, and I hope he'll find his way up to the table to testify when I'm done here. But just to let you know that 30% of Minnesota's 87 counties already have a Project Lifesaver program, and this has been done primarily by groups like my constituent, who has started a nonprofit and has been able to fund the local law enforcement agencies to get the training. That isn't true across the state, and we now have an inequity that has grown. So this grant program is hopefully going to help the other counties or law enforcement agency partnerships, sometimes it's city, county, and other groups that come together to do the training, so that individuals who will wear a bracelet similar to this and wander off are able to be located very quickly, and I'll let him describe how that happens, and brought home safely to their loved one. There's a substantial cost savings for police departments when this is used as opposed to the old-fashioned method, which is scanning an area and hoping you have the right area, and sometimes we have poor results with that. So this particular program will allow for better results. Mr. Chair, before I have my testifier come down, I did want to ask a technical question of the committee. The Senate has heard this bill and has seen fit to take out subdivisions 5, 6, and 8. And having just talked with the department that will be doing this grant, they believe that those sections could be removed here, too. If you're open to an oral amendment to remove them, we can do so. If you'd rather do that in a conference committee, should you lay this bill over for inclusion and include it, it could be done there. So it's up to the chair and the committees.
Any objections from the DFL? No. That's a substantial amendment, but as long as we're all in agreement, how about you folks? It does. What does it do by removing those?
It takes out several provisions that do rulemaking, which isn't needed, that sets up an account in the state treasury, which also isn't needed, and it has a component that has a report back to the House of Representatives, which apparently the department already does in a larger grant reporting back system, and they don't need this additional language. So it doesn't change the rest of the bill and how it's administered. It just gives the department the ability to do it the way they see fit best.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to make that a motion.
Okay, why don't you restate the amendment, oral amendment, Representative Schoen or Representative Norton, that you'd like to move.
So I think I heard her say strike subdivision 5, 6, and 8.
Okay. Representative Norton, the chair will move your amendment to strike sections 5, 6, and 8. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, with that, I've given a quick overview of the program, and I'll answer questions later, but Mr. Trahan has come from Rochester, and he's kind of been the individual in the area of autism that has worked really hard to provide funding for many of the law enforcement agencies across the state already to be able to provide this, and he'll tell you a little more. And I'm very sorry we don't have our law enforcement folks with us today. They were up here yesterday or day before for Senator Senjum's bill hearing, and we couldn't get them back. Their time's precious. So.
Okay. Go ahead, sir, for your name and organization and begin.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brad Trahan, T-R-A-H-A-N, Rochester, Minnesota. Appreciate you having us here today and hearing this bill. I'm also the father of a son with severe autism. And back in 2007, I learned of a young boy in Wisconsin that went missing on a Friday. He had autism and wrestled over about the situation. Went over on a Monday. They had to call the search off due to the weather. And when I drove in on a Tuesday, I drove in and saw all this water to my left and to my right, all the wooded area, and a 7-year-old was missing, and he had autism. And just to see the command post that was set up across the street from the family, all the volunteers being checked in, being numbered, whatnot, buses, Red Cross, it was just an amazing search. And the next day we took part, and I can tell you, the enthusiasm that everyone thought Benji was alive was there. Everyone was just spirited to go out and find Benji. We went out on the search and came back, got our beverages and food because we're going to have to go back out. And then a veteran law enforcement officer pulls everyone together. And he starts tearing up, and he said that Benji had been found dead in a pond just south of his home, probably 200 to 300 yards. It hit me hard. It haunts me today. I'll never forget the weeping across the street from the family. But then I noticed a veteran law enforcement officer kind of sneak away, went behind a pickup truck and sat on the tailgate. He broke down and cried. And I told him he did everything he could, and he said, I didn't do enough. And I went back to Benji's funeral that same Saturday in the local gymnasium. And I just vowed to myself, I never ever again want to see a mom and dad kiss their child's casket knowing he's in a better place. If we have technology to help local law enforcement, public safety find these individuals. It's just not about autism. It's about Down syndrome. It's about Alzheimer's. It's about dementia. It's what we can do to take care of our most vulnerable. I want, for full transparency reasons, I am on the volunteer board of directors for Project Lifesaver, based out of Virginia. There's many other technology programs out there, but they've been widely known and respected. This transmitter bracelet sometimes gets confused as a GPS. It's better. It's a radio frequency, FM frequency. Each individual that's on this program has a frequency assigned to it. So me as a parent, if I'm missing my son, he goes out wandering and missing, I can do a quick search. But then I'm calling 911 and activating the Project Lifesaver team. They go to the last known area where that individual has gone missing. They come in with antennas on their squads, and this transmitter has a beep per second. Once they pick up that beep, then they go to the mobile walk-in transmitter. The average length of time they're finding individuals is 30 minutes. Since 1999, there's been 2,976 finds and no fatalities. It can locate individuals up to 1 mile on the ground, 1 to 2 miles on the ground, and 10 to 20 miles in the air. This training is also provided that if my son went missing, and let's just say, God forbid, he drowns, there's been times that searches have gone on for these individuals for days, weeks, seasons, and no locations. Through training, this picks up individuals in water, up to 12 feet of water, 20 feet away. It's been trained to do that. So at least it would give that family some solace knowing that their loved one has been found. I'm very passionate about this. I've been honored to help out in southeastern Minnesota get this going. I spoke out in the state of North Dakota in October. The Human Services received a grant, went out there, spoke, and I'm just happy to announce that March we got a first county in North Dakota going on it. This is truly about saving lives, because at the end of the day, my friends, when someone goes missing, especially someone that's vulnerable, it's up to government, i.e. police and fire, to go find that individual. And if we have technology to help those individuals, if public safety go find those individuals quicker, faster, and many times alive, that's what it's all about. I thank you for your time, and I'll certainly entertain any questions that you may have.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, my experience is with an elderly engineer with dementia. Representative Norton and I talked about this a little bit before, but I think it would be helpful to the committee. A wristband would have occupied him a fairly short period of time. He would have had it off. And could you talk a little bit about the ways that it can be secured on a person that they're not going to be able to engineer it off?
Go ahead.
Chair Cornish, thank you, Representative. Can this technically be cut off? It can be. At the same token, we've had great success where the individuals actually get used to it. It could go on the person's on their ankle, on their wrist. It can go on them where it just doesn't even seem like a bother to them. For your example, we actually had that situation in Olmsted County where an individual with Alzheimer's went missing. He was found over, it took 24 hours. They reenacted that same scenario in Olmsted County. They would have had that individual found in 1 hour, under 1 hour's time. So imagine a cold, bitter night and whatnot. That individual may not have made it 24 hours. So could it technically be cut off? Could it technically, if someone really tried to force it off? It could be. But what we have found is the individual truly gets used to it, like a wristwatch, or it's part of their person. So we've had great success where it doesn't really truly get removed.
Okay, Representative, I guess there's nobody else on the list. Any other questions, members? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the very short time that I have been in the legislature, I think this is the first thing that I would say is absolutely a no-brainer. Not only does it save lives, but the amount of money that it would save in rescue opportunities and things is just amazing. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Any other questions from members? Questions from the public? Representative Norton, any closing comments? Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish and members, I would say a couple things just in closing. This has had great bipartisan support and in all the committees we've been in, and that's been really heartening. It's a voluntary program that police departments can, if they so choose, participate in. The money will be given out first come, first serve. It is 100% scalable. There will be, we don't have a fiscal note, but apparently the Senate did. And what I can tell you from the Senate's fiscal note is that it was a 0.25 staff person at the department that they felt that, and having spoken with folks here today too, that they think they would need to pull the whole thing off. Other than that, it's completely scalable. So we believe that about $300,000 would cover everybody in the state if everyone wanted to participate. We know that isn't true. We know some departments aren't going to be interested. So it's completely scalable. If you have $100,000 to put into the loan program, we would make great headway in getting departments trained. It takes about $4,000 for the training for the department, as well as the equipment that they have as well, and then $2,000 that will be needed for retraining as new law enforcement officers come on departments and they need to retrain them. So completely scalable, and we do hope you'll find a small amount of money to put in really build capacity in all of our law enforcement agencies that are interested in participating, rather than just the about 30% that we have now.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Norton, for presenting your bill. And with that, we'll hold over House File 1056 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Representative O'Neill, House File 21. Oh, which one? We're going to Representative Hancock. House File 233. Okay, Representative Hancock, I will move your bill to be held over for possible inclusion. Go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 233. Basically relates to civil commitment. It clarifies the alternative to use interactive video conferencing in civil commitments. It's very permissive in its language. It just says that it may be used in civil commitments in conjunction with Minnesota Rules of Civil Commitment, Rule 14 and Rule 131. It's not meant to interfere with any rights of due process. It merely recognizes and codifies the valuable use of interactive video conferencing in not only law enforcement, but in the judicial system.
Hey, members, questions? Any testifiers?
Not that I'm aware of that are here today, sir.
Sounds like a good bill. I checked with a couple of judges myself about that, and they thought that would be a good idea. If there are no questions, yeah, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think you and I discussed the Nicollet County Sheriff talking about having to drive to Fargo three times in a week, or sending a deputy up for basically a five-minute commitment hearing. And so, again, ends up saving a whole lot of money and a lot of law enforcement time when they don't have to do that. So, mm-hmm. Be supportive. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hancock, like I said in the Civil Law Committee, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. A lot of sheriff's offices drive lots of miles for a five-minute hearing. And it's not just one day. It's two, three, sometimes 4 days a week that these people have to do a short hearing. Your bill is going to save the counties a lot of funding. I want to thank you for bringing it forward.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I may, just in a few closing comments, it's not that we don't have testifiers. We have had in the past. The Sheriff's Association has testified, and public defenders have testified. I think it's pretty much a non-controversial bill, and I think it does help law enforcement greatly in terms of the time commitment. And I think when it comes to, you know, the Rule 31 and 14 or 131 and 14, maybe those are things that need to be addressed in the future. This bill is not intended to do that. It's simply to codify interactive video conferencing.
Thank you. Yes, you get points in this committee for brevity, so especially we got session at noon. This will allow us probably to get out a little earlier, grab a bite before we go. So with that, hold over House File 233 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And now, Representative O'Neill. House File 2152, and you can move your own bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2152 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, Representative O'Neill, go ahead with however you'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the sake of brevity, essentially this is a bill brought forth by the scrap metal industry, and I'm privileged to have a fantastic facility in my district. It is one of the top five in the nation for what they do and have toured it many times, and actually took the Small Business Caucus there to tour it because they do such great work. And so through that, the problem that we're bringing today actually started back in 2007. We started addressing this problem legislatively and work groups and things like that. So through that working group in the last session, there was an agreement made between law enforcement and the scrap dealers to come up with some regulations. One component of that has not been fulfilled, which is a database. So the database that was supposed to be created by the City of Minneapolis and the Police Department of Minneapolis, even though they've gone through all the process with the working group to decide what should be in it, right now it has not been created. And the concern in the industry is that when they are required to put information into a database that doesn't exist, in 2016, so February 15th of 2016, they need to start putting their information in. So it's names and transactions and quite a bit of information, anything that was purchased by them from the clients. That database doesn't exist. And so we don't believe in the foreseeable future that it will be. It just is kind of stalled in the process. So if we don't come now and before the legislature to give them some relief from that, they're going to be out of compliance with the law, which is really unfortunate. So this bill basically repeals the requirement for the database. We can certainly look at that at another point, but right now it doesn't exist, and it doesn't look like it's going to be existing in the foreseeable future. So in brief, that's what the bill does, and I have a couple of testifiers here to speak more in detail.
Welcome, Mr. Cassidy. You state your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Minneapolis Law Firm of Stinson Leonard Street. We represent the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries in the state of Minnesota. I also have with me Mr. Tony White, who can answer questions if need be. I'll just Representative Neal did a great job giving background and also what the problem is right now in terms of being in compliance with the law that we passed 2 years ago. This goes back to 2007 when law enforcement identified problems with scrap theft that were occurring just on the cusp of the recession with copper tubing and copper wiring mostly. In 2012, Ramsey County Attorney John Choi busted a auto theft ring in the city of St. Paul and successfully prosecuted those folks that were involved in that. But it highlighted a problem with stolen cars, which were being taken off the streets in the middle of the night, taken to scrap yards and shredded, literally, without any proof of ownership or title. So we added cars into the scrap metal recycling mix as well, legislation. So if you take a look at the back of the information sheet we have, these are all the requirements that scrap recyclers are required to gather from any customer, law-abiding or otherwise, that comes through their door with a scrap transaction. So we're not doing away with collecting information for law enforcement purposes. We're only repealing that portion of the law that has to do with the creation of a new database that would be added on to the automated pawn system, which the Minneapolis Police Department already operates. And I think probably at the end of the day, the issue that we have with bringing scrap metal into the mix of an automated pawn system is that it's not apples to apples. When you highlight or when you report a TV that comes through a pawn shop's door, it's got a lot of identifiers on it. It's got a brand, it's got a model, it's got a model number. When you bring scrap through the door and try and report it and identify it, have some identifying information, it's tough to sort out. And at the end of the day, we weren't able to come to any conclusions. It's not that we're walking away from this. We're going to continue to talk to law enforcement. We always do. That's part of our job, is cooperating with them to try and find criminals that are coming through our door and trying to transact business. With that, I will answer any questions from the committee, and I also have Mr. White with me.
Representative Hillstrom and Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, one, why are you planning to just remove it from Minneapolis and not from the other folks that, you know, why just specific to Minneapolis? And if it's a problem with the timing of the database, why not just put it out instead of repealing the necessary entering of the... So it's great that you keep track of all that information, but if you have the same people coming in over and over and over again and they're selling you the same kind of pipe over and over and over again, and clearly they're not in the business of recycling that kind of pipe, you kind of start to get to see some patterns of criminal activity. And if you're not putting it into a database anywhere that's searchable, it all depends on whether or not you have the memory of some great clerk. I've prosecuted a couple of these cases where folks, you know, will steal a big old spool and then cut up the wire and then take it to a scrap metal dealer. Why would you not want to have that information trackable to absolve you of your responsibility to make sure you're reporting and not a participant in the criminal activity?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll go to your first question, which is Minneapolis. This isn't about Minneapolis. It just so happens that when they created the automated pawn system, I believe in 1995, Minneapolis actually created it for the state. So any jurisdiction that wanted to participate in the automated pawn system, they could, meaning any law enforcement agencies. So it just so happens that that system is housed and run by the Minneapolis Police Department. So it's not that we're just picking on Minneapolis in this repeal. Second, why wouldn't we want to do this? We're going to open up a whole can of worms that we had a debate of 2 or 3 years ago, but we haven't come to any conclusions on how to actually do this properly. And it's been sitting on the shelf for well over a year after numerous task force meetings, working group meetings, and hasn't gone anywhere. And our industry now is sitting there thinking, are we out of compliance or going to be out of compliance shortly? The idea of a reportable database obviously sounds great. We would argue that criminals they know better than to go to places and sell stuff where their pictures and their information is going to be recorded. And we can argue over that. We can, obviously. And I've seen it in the pawn industry, that people go to Craigslist, they go to eBay, they go to secondhand stores before they ever walk into a pawn shop to get rid of merchandise if it's illegal. So it's a whole other issue. And then I will go to what I originally testified to, which is it's a much more difficult reporting process because of the material that you're dealing with. It's, you know, what's the difference between one bucket of copper versus another? One's brought in by a local plumber on a Saturday morning. One's brought in by a criminal who ripped it off from a plumber out of the back of his pickup.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone who has prosecuted these property crimes for the last 5 years, I can tell you criminals pawn them at pawn shops all the time, and I get the video and their picture and their face pawning it. Scrap metal dealers as well. And so if you don't want to report, what if we then hold you criminally liable for being a participant in the same way we do if business is selling alcohol to minors or selling tobacco to minors? So if you are not doing your responsibility, if you don't want to put it in a database and allow law enforcement to do their job, what if we turn it and make it your responsibility and hold you liable in the same way we do if you sell liquor to minors or tobacco?
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you already have that authority to prosecute the industry if they're breaking the law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I won't say every single scrap dealer, because there's some that are very, very small, but by and large, they have a database at their place of business now. You know, like maybe not every single one. By and large, most of them do. And they keep all that information. And I know at least the one that is in my district, they work with law enforcement all the time, and law enforcement comes in. In fact, they will tell law enforcement, hey, you know what, so-and-so brought in this strange stuff, and they will actually call law enforcement and say, you probably should check into this. Now, maybe that's unique to my district, but I don't think it is. But I know you're going to ask another question, but the other issue is that there is they've hit a roadblock where this database was supposed to be created. So we need to do something different. So this is a solution, and maybe it's not the solution. Again, you know, you and I talked about that quite a bit, Representative Hellstrom. But right now they're very worried about being out of compliance, and this is kind of our last chance to address this before the next session, because if we wait, they're going to be out of compliance. They don't want to be out of compliance. I think the industry wants to be compliant. They want to work with law enforcement. They do work with law enforcement. They, in their place of business, they have a lot of this information in their own databases, and they do share it with, in fact, I know, like I said, if ART was here, they're a fantastic recycler in my district, and they actually call law enforcement and say, you know, that it just seems out of character here. But, you know, maybe we could talk about this more if we're just going to be laying it over, but we can look at this a little bit more. But right now, this database isn't happening, I guess is the best way to put it. And we want to make sure that an industry isn't out of compliance and out of compliance with the law if it's not going to happen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, right now I think you have a really bad bill. And if you really wanted to do something to help make that database happen, maybe some money to make it happen or something. Every single industry, every pawnbroker, when we did the automated pawnbroker bill and making people put things in database, said, we all keep track. We all do a great job. We have no criminals coming here. That's what they all said. And so I don't see any difference in this industry than that industry, and we passed a law saying that they needed to comply. There's a problem with the database not existing. We either, one, should help create it, or two, delay the implementation date so that it actually can be built. I don't think we should re-debate whether or not they should comply, because the legislature already determined that they should. So I'm a no on your bill.
I would strongly disagree. I like the bill. I've been on this conversation since this thing started years ago, and if they were that important to do the database, they would have it done by now. And they're not getting rid of all the regulations. If the only thing we're talking about here is the database, the other regulations they've all had to come under has happened already, and I do plan on including this in the omnibus bill. But questions from other members? Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Neill. This just came in last minute, introduced on Tuesday. I had conversations with folks even over the last year that there wasn't going to be any legislation about this, and so my comments, especially after hearing what I've heard today, I want to make clear I'm not directing them at you, because I haven't talked to you about this, but I am extremely disappointed with the information I've heard today, because what was relayed to me about this bill was not a repeal of getting the database, or not to have to do the database at all. My understanding was that this was somehow a work arrangement to get past the alleged impasse between Minneapolis and your organization, Mr. Cassidy, and not just to do away with it at all, because there's other options out there. I've heard about this group out in Michigan. Michigan has a reporting system in place. I thought we were going to, this was trying to put together some funds to figure out how we were going to do this at the state level, not repeal this at all. Because if that's the case, we can go, and Minneapolis didn't even know you were bringing this bill forward. Because it's pretty easy. I mean, it would be even beneficial to put in the names of the people that bring the scrap in and just what they scrap. It doesn't have to be exactly what it is. And I have been to the several scrap yards. There's one in Minneapolis that's amazing. Does probably the benchmark of where scrap yards should be. And, you know, some copper piping is stamped and is identifiable because of its structural uses or otherwise, or whether it's for fire code or high pressure, low pressure. So that can happen. Those things are there. Even some of the wire, I mean, some of the wiring that comes in is very identifiable because it's very specific. So I would be okay with extending or modifying some of the things that would have to go into APS, if that was the case, to say so it would at least fit what we can search today when I'm at work, to go, hey, Nick Zerwas has been pawning copper wire in Duluth, Hugo, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rochester. That would be, I don't think that would be too burdensome. And it's pretty handy because then at least you know where to go and where to track down. And then I can call that pawn shop or that scrap yard and go, hey, I've seen Mr. Zerwas has been all over the state. When was he last in? I see he was in on, do you remember what he brought in? Or what do you have? Because then I can at least track down and go to that place and then get what they have on file, whether it's pictures or otherwise. But to just repeal it and then try to have to search all over the state, I mean, there's things we could do. I don't know if you're tracking me here, Mr. Chair, but I think that there's ways that we could work the legislation into what might fit into the APS versus just repeal it altogether. Now that I'm hearing what I'm hearing, because I'm disappointed that we're talking about a full repeal of that particular section of law.
Mr. Cassidy, could you answer the comment first?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoen, first of all, we've explored both. We've explored full repeal and we've explored extending it out. I believe we've extended it out twice now, and absolutely nothing has happened. I will tell you that I also think there is a lack of interest to get this done by Minneapolis. I'm not going to accuse DPS of anything, but I think there's been discussions that whether or not DPS would like to take this over or BCA, that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And I think we're kind of sitting here on an island right now trying to figure out, you know, who's going to do it and how is it going to get done. Because I think we've put a lot of resources into trying to make it happen. I don't think we've stood in the way of making it happen. It's just nothing has happened. And we're going to be out of compliance. And we've got businesses out there that are fearful that they will be or that they are. And I will go back again. Any law enforcement officer can walk through the door of any scrap recycler in the state and grab information. They can look for trends. They can pull data. We will do runs for them. I've never heard of a scrapyard not cooperating with law enforcement. In fact, I think the very scrapyard that you probably toured spends an inordinate amount of time there looking at records. They have Minneapolis has an actual, at least they used to, had a one of their law enforcement officers actually assigned to go and do those types of things. So it's already happening, and I think it's working. But we sit here year in and year out, and nothing's happening with this database, and we'd like to repeal it this year. We're not walking away. We're not going to be at the table talking. We'll talk to DPS. We'll talk to Minneapolis. We'll talk to anybody. But we feel this needs to be repealed this year.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cassidy, how many scrap dealers or reclaimers do you represent in Minnesota, or how many are there in Minnesota?
60 in our organization.
Okay.
Large, medium to small.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to get at is that it, in one swoop, a task force can track an individual to scrapping all over the state, or just like we can with pawn systems. And I'm not comfortable with a full repeal. I understand the need to extend the time. And, you know, if we've been sitting there and DPU, you feel like you get the impression that DPS doesn't want to do it, well, I don't think that Chair Cornish really cares what any agency wants to or doesn't want to do, quite frankly, since we set the rules here. And if we think it's a statewide need, then we need to fund it and we need to deal with it. And I don't think that there'd be any disagreement with that. But the issue is you have some amazing members that do amazing work. Like I said, there are some that aren't so great, but that goes with any business. And the reality is that scrap metal is rife with the ability to have fraudulent transactions. Not necessarily just the dealer. I'm talking about some of the folks that bring the stuff in. And and that's a big issue. It has been in my district when it's construction projects or someone coming into the park and ride and augering off a bunch of catalytic converters. Mm-hmm. And there are those people out there that will certainly take them. But there needs to be incentive in this bill to get back to the table versus just the full repeal in my mind. Otherwise, we're just opening up an area that we shouldn't be.
Mr. Kessie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoen, I want to clarify my remarks on DPS. It's not a lack of effort or anything. I just don't think they've really thought it through or thought about it. It's an issue that I think possibly Minneapolis has talked to them about, but I don't think they have a position. But there obviously can be a discussion moving forward on whether or not someone else should house the automated pawn system. So I want to make that clear. Thank you.
Really? Representative Zerwas.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, thank you. So 3 years ago, this was Representative Mahoney's bill. I was the number two author, huge proponent of this. I've spent 2 years going to stakeholder meetings with the city of Minneapolis and Mr. Cassidy's group and representatives group. I will tell you, at all points over the last several years, Mr. Cassidy's group and the city of Minneapolis worked very well together. They worked very hard on getting the language the same. You know, a pipe isn't a pipe isn't a pipe. I learned so much about scrap metal. It's terrifying. Not real handy. but what I'll tell you is what's happened over the course of the last 18 months is there was within the division of the Minneapolis Police Department that executes APS and other technological missions for the Minneapolis Police Department, is it was a very significant leadership change. And when that leadership change occurred, the priorities of the Minneapolis Police Department, quite frankly, changed. And so 3 years ago, when Minneapolis was insistent that the database be done by the city of Minneapolis, the first draft of Representative Mahoney's bill had DPS monitoring the database. And Minneapolis said, no, we do this already. If we're going to do a database, it needs to be a part of ours. That was in the Wayback Machine. If we go to today, a few months ago, I had Chief Arto and I think two or three deputy chiefs in my office, and they said, Representative Zerwas, we have no interest in doing this program. Please take this off our plate. We're in talks with DPS to see if they have an interest in doing it, but the Minneapolis Police Department does not have an interest in doing it. And so I met with the commissioner, and I met with Commissioner Dolman, and I said, do you have an interest in doing this? And she said she had heard about it briefly. That wasn't on their radar. It certainly wasn't a priority for them, but they would study it and consider it. And I think that's a possible move forward, is the idea of finding if there's some resources to allow the Department of Public Safety to study potentially doing something like this in the future. But right now, we have an idea with no money and no one that cares about it to implement it. That being said, I know we talked a little bit about compliance, but we also have a fee structure that goes along with this that will be implemented into every single transaction. And we have a fee structure that what would be collecting fees for? There's no program. We've gone for two different years now pushing extensions out because there's no program. Now, let's be clear. What is collected on every single person that drives to a scrapyard to unload scrap? A photograph of them, their license plate information, their a Xerox of their photo ID, a description of what they scrap. We do not yet have it organized in a computer system, and we have no agency with an interest in doing that right now. That being said, I think it's best to release this burden from the industry while we figure out if the state has an interest in pursuing this. In my last conversation with the Department of Public Safety, they said we have a lot of projects on our plate, and this isn't on the radar. This certainly wouldn't be a priority.
Okay.
We have very competent people in our state agencies. I think we ought to let them run their agencies.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure
sure who this goes to, if it goes to you, Representative, or you, Mr. Cassidy. I'm trying to understand when you say it hasn't been implemented, it hasn't worked. Is that because the people at the table haven't been able to come to an agreement on what it should be, what it should look like? Is this purely a technological issue? I'm trying to understand the dynamics, because when I look at this, we spend a lot of time, I think, trying to put something in place that it doesn't sound like we're there yet. And I hope that in all the programs that we try to implement and put in place in the state, if we don't get there as fast as we'd hope, that I hope we don't just abandon them, because I think that that's what we're doing, is we're going back on something. And, I certainly understand that, people come in, they get their photos taken, they get all that other stuff. But I don't know of too many police departments that have the time to be going to look at the records of each of the scrap places to figure out if there's, some type of, racketeering, or if there's a system in place that there are a bunch of individuals that are doing something, whereas that's what a database is actually for, is trying to discern, are there some things happening that we need to be alarmed at? So I guess my first question back to that is this been because of I don't want to say unwillingness, but maybe an inability to come to an agreement what should be part of and how this database should be operated? And then second of all, personally, I don't think we should abandon it. I think maybe we put this out a year, and if we are collecting fees, that somehow that fees then go into trying to make sure that what we put in place is a really good thing.
Mr. Cassidy, did you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we definitely would be opposed to collecting fees on something that isn't or hasn't been implemented and for the purpose it was supposed to be. We spent numerous weeks and months in task force and working group meetings, and we did come to a conclusion of some framework for what needed to be a part of any kind of system like this. And from there, we thought moving away from the Minneapolis APS system by putting an RFP on the street, whether it would be an RFP or an RFI, so we can invite others. I think Representative Schoen referenced one. Michigan, I don't believe, has implemented anything yet. I think they're struggling as well with how to do it. There are some national systems that I think folks have looked at, both at within law enforcement and within our organization, that are fairly new. I also think the urgency has passed. I think that there has been, in 2007 and 2012, some urgency and a crisis with stolen car ring. But you've also, I think Representative Zerwas pointed out, that there's, priorities have changed. And both within, I think, the Minneapolis Police Department, and other agencies, that this simply isn't a priority. And we haven't seen the urgency as well over the course of the last couple of years.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Dean,
I would love it if the city of Minneapolis is willing to come down and make some comments, because they've been referenced probably about 45 times or more in the past, and possibly the BCA and some of the work as well, if they could come down and make some comments.
And, okay. Mr. Chair, can I just I want to make sure. We're talking about Minneapolis just by virtue of the fact that they are housing this.
I understand that. Okay. Understand that.
We're not blaming it.
Yes. Yeah.
Go ahead and introduce yourself and your organization. Begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa Lesh with the City of Minneapolis. Thank you for the questions. And I think that members have laid out some of the roadblocks and some of the history that we've experienced. I think Mr. Cassidy did describe the experience with the stakeholder group accurately, that we did have really productive meetings where I think we did decide on a good framework and the way that we would kind of go about the concept of tracking scrap metal. And to your question, Representative Dean, I think we did run into a technological problem, that once we kind of had the concept of what we need to move forward, when we really kind of opened up the hood and looked at, some of the, the specs when it comes to the technology, words that I don't know and code that I can't read, it wasn't as easy to add a component onto the existing system, I think, as we anticipated, and that it would take more time than we initially had budgeted for in the original legislation, and then the extension that this legislature passed last year. It was just more complicated than expected. It would take more time and more resources to build a system that would work for law enforcement, but also one that really would work for industry. It's really important to us that this works for our scrap dealers. I think Mr. Cassidy mentioned that we have a fantastic relationship with our scrap dealers within the city of Minneapolis. I know that's true for a lot of law enforcement throughout the state. And, you know, as the saying goes, garbage in, garbage out. If the system doesn't work for private industry, it's not going to work on the back end for law enforcement. So we really want it to be a strong system. And we could have moved forward with something that really didn't work for private industry and then in the end wouldn't work for law enforcement. We had a cost estimate for that, and there were some concerns from our partners on the other side of the table from the industry that the cost looked pretty high because of the unexpected technological challenges that we did uncover. And because of that, rather than moving forward with something that they were uncomfortable with that looked like it might be more expensive than they had anticipated, we pulled back and said, okay, then we will evaluate some other options. And that's kind of what's led to some discussion with DPS. That's what's led to a discussion about, you know, potentially releasing an RFP, because it really isn't within the wheelhouse of a law enforcement agency to also be a software development company. So is it best processed in a different way? But I think I speak for the rest of the members of the law enforcement part of this equation, really would not want to see a full repeal without this being replaced with something. That this legislature and everyone at the table has agreed that there does need to be some system in place for the tracking and monitoring of scrap metal. It needs to work for everyone, but having nothing is not something we'd be comfortable with. Moving it to another location, another process, we would be interested in talking about that, but not having anything to take the place of using the APS system, I think is something that, you know, would be challenging.
It's a little different because I haven't heard anything from law enforcement since it started on this database complaint or wishing it was. So we'll have to force the system on somebody who doesn't really want to do it, paid for with money that we don't have. We really don't know if it's going to do any good once we do it. So to me, it's just something we should not do. So no. Representative Schoen.
Well, I was going to do a quick follow-up if I can.
Then Representative Dean. Go on.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So has the city of Minneapolis over the past couple of years invested, I want to say, lots of resources to try to develop a system as you move forward? And is the city or the police department or folks looking at this and saying, we've already invested X amount of dollars, and our ability to continue pumping money into this to try to make something work just doesn't pencil out as a possibility? I guess I'm trying to understand, you know, who's got a lot of skin in the game already, and why are they trying to get out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, I think that we have invested lots, and I don't have a dollar amount for you, but I think the word lots is probably accurate. But I think also there is a public policy recognition that, you know, the stakeholder process worked the way that it was intended to work, that we came to the table, we all had a really good, fruitful discussion. We've looked at the code, we've looked at the software. The process has worked how it was meant to work. The legislature could have just said, it is APS and just get it done, but the stakeholder group was included in the legislation for a reason. And I think that it worked how it was supposed to work, which was we had that discussion and we've come to the point now where maybe this is a statewide resource. Maybe housed within a small department within the city of Minneapolis, if it's a statewide tool, is not the best public policy. And so, yes, we have invested resources, financially and staff time into that, but if that's the right result and if that's better for everyone at the table, then, you know, I think we're fine cutting our losses. We really just really want, I think, the best result for everyone involved.
We've got Representatives Schoen and Hillstrom, then we've got another presentation by the Civil Legal Services yet to do before we're 5-2. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I find myself in an odd place to be in just slight disagreement with you. No, just Mr. Chair, on your statement that, you know, no one's contacted you or been concerned about it, I've been in the same spot as well, because I've been under the impression this has been worked on for the last couple of years. And we passed something that had a fee-based system to it that would pay for the needs or a great majority of it, and that was the goal. And so, I mean, that's my understanding. Is that not correct? The idea is that the fees are going to help pay for the system, and I think I've had conversations with you in Minneapolis about APS as a whole. I mean, no matter where you are in the state of Minnesota, whether you're in Wilmer, Bemidji, St. Cloud, APS was put together by Minneapolis, and, you know, every time I logged onto the system for work, I just reminded how grateful I was that Minneapolis took the lead on this, because it made our work so much easier. And I don't know if you, and if none of, if you haven't used it, but it seems to me that if we couldn't find the full marriage of scrap metal to APS, at a minimum, we could still put in names and just like, this is what they brought that day. And it doesn't have to be as descriptive, because I understand that the modules, like you talk about, are difficult to change for that, to put that system together. But it's that tracking that makes the job of law enforcement so much easier. Because otherwise, I'm calling Minneapolis PD, their person that handles that scrap metal all the time, or you're trying to work through this, and it can be quite laborious, and a lot of things just get missed that way. And plus, after a while, they see your phone ring, and they're like, oh, crap, Sean's calling again. So, I mean, right? I mean, you know how that works. After a while, you don't want to, you're like, I got my own work to do. Yeah, all my cohorts do. So I just don't, the repeal is not the right way to go. I understand the need for us to have some changes. If the funding, I disagree, it is needed, it is wanted. Law enforcement does want this. You know, this just came off the floor 3 days ago, and here we are, which is, I don't have a problem with that, but it's going to be difficult in this particular circumstance for me to support the bill the way it stands. However, we do need to make sure that our dealers that are in compliance. So I'm in agreement with Mr. Cassidy. We need to find that avenue to make sure that they're protected and not get prosecuted for something they can't control. And then let's fix it. But there are things that I think we could do differently than what this bill does that would be much better for all of Minnesota.
Okay. Any other? Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I just want to make it clear that, you know, if we wanted to play games with the committee, we could, you know, ask to take a vote right now. We would have the votes to take down the bill, I think, at this moment. So that is not the intention.
Before I recess, you mean?
Yeah. So I just want to make that clear that, you know, this isn't about game playing. This is about really doing what's right. And in Minneapolis, one of the reasons we started talking about this was because copper was very expensive. And so people were stealing copper from houses while the gas was still on and houses were exploding. So the idea that this isn't a serious issue that needs to be addressed and that we should just repeal it, I think is, it really underestimates the issue of why we did it in the first place. So while the database may be a problem, we're having all sorts of database issues with all sorts of other areas of government, as we've heard about in the press.
We're trying to repeal those, too.
Yeah, well, that might be your style, Representative Zerwas. But I just think that you should think about that as we move forward.
And Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I look at this in a slightly different way. When I was working for the Blue Earth County Sheriff's Office, I dealt with a family from La Hillier, and I'm guessing that if he wanted to, he could name them, the chair, rather, that this was their family enterprise. They went out and stole scrap and then took it all over southern Minnesota. And I don't know, I'd like to make life as difficult as I could for them. Because that's actually what they did, and they did it over a number of years. And they, well, not too well. They kept bouncing into jail, but eventually. But they would do it for years at a time, and they were notorious for it. So I think anything we can do to make life more difficult for those people is actually probably a good thing.
Representative, anybody else left? All right, where are we at? Mr. Franklin, you were waving your arms up there. You wanted to say something?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I was not going to testify on this particular thing. I didn't even know it existed to the extent it did. I will try to be very brief and very concise. Number one, I appreciate, Representative Zerwas, your information this morning. I've gained more in your minute and a half than I've heard about this topic in the last year and a half. And I'm disappointed that the information was not sent out in a broader format with regards to that discussion. Your sheriff has been one of the people that has been a driving force behind this. Number two, if you've not heard about this in or from your sheriffs, it's because we thought it was getting handled and the details were being worked out. When we came to the table, sheriffs were skeptical of this to start with. We border North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin. We were concerned about scrap going across the border. And we were concerned about the lack of interface. And we opted to opt into the APS system, of which is a good system. And a number of agencies in Minnesota have it. And we were hoping and promised that that system would link to the other state systems. And I get the idea of the cost. And I get the idea that it costs more. And as Bud Schaefer said a few moments ago, every conversation we have, it's about money. And that's what this boils down to. I'll summarize my comments by saying we would not support this bill to a repeal. Extend the deadline. We got to get back to the table with this knowledge that we now have and put new forces behind this to figure it out. But to abandon this only simply continues to drive the problem of when we started with this, which was local units of government spending tons of money driving from Kuchiching, Minnesota to Minneapolis to check a scrap metal dealer's license, and all of those costs, or worse yet, we close the case file and nothing is ever done to pursue the criminal. All of those are costs to us as taxpayers, us as consumers. So pay me now, pay me later. How we develop and design the system, I think, is a collaboration we have to do, and we cannot lose focus of our system interacting with the states around us because of the importance of the interstate systems and travels that we have. With that, I'll conclude, sir.
Well, the one question I have is we haven't had a database, but I haven't had any complaints from law enforcement that we haven't had the database. I mean, how come it's so important if I never heard about any complaints about not having it? I mean, if nobody using it and nobody noticed that it was there, now all of a sudden, without it, we can't survive.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to answer that. I've been taking the calls for you, screening them, and telling people we're working on them. I'll be happy to send them to you, and I can send you the electrical co-ops as of 2 weeks ago about the copper thefts, and the Irrigation Association's concerns about irrigation piping being stolen. I'll be happy to send them to you. But we have sort of funneled those in, to be very honest, telling law enforcement we're working on this, we're working on this. They have been on my tail because it's not done. And I, frankly, have not been driving and working as hard on this as I probably should. Paul and the others have done a good job. People have really tried to work on this, and to throw anybody under the bus totally isn't fair. But I think we have a system where we thought APS was going to work. We thought things were going to get done. Priorities have shifted. Now we have to really go back and redesign the vehicle.
Hey, Representative Zerwas, we haven't got another presentation yet. I don't know if we'll get it in or not, but go ahead.
Just briefly, Chair Cornish, I'm going to want to thank Mr. Franklin for coming down. The only comment I'll make is, as you talked about the idea of money or being the problem, I don't think this is a financial issue. And I've talked to the stakeholders. The city of Minneapolis did not ask me for a bill to fund this. When I talked to the Commissioner of Public Safety, while she said, if you hand this off to me, I better get money, she had no interest in doing this for money. She said it still was not on their list of priorities, on their radar, was the word she had used. I think this is a priorities issue, and I think this is a fundamental strategic vision issue, where the strategic vision for the Minneapolis Police Department has simply shifted. And perhaps Chief Hartow can come in at some point, and we can have the same discussion that I had in my office. But the fact of the matter is the shift, the vision and the direction of that department within her police agency has fundamentally shifted. They have told me flat out this is not a priority of their agency. They should be in the bad guy arresting business and not the computer network building business.
All right, let's close it out and hold it over. The Civil Legal Services wants to make a presentation. They drove here from around the state. So with that, we'll hold the bill over for possible inclusion, House File 2152. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Sorry to rush you. All right. When you come up now, rather than give us a slide by slide of what you do, really, really only interested in bringing you back to find out what specifically you need the extra money for, okay, what you would be spending it on. So you can, you don't have to go through the whole presentation.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathy Hockadall. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Thank you so much for having us here today. And many of you we had an opportunity to meet with earlier in the session, and we very much appreciate that. I do want to introduce the people who came from Greater Minnesota to be here today. They are not going to be speaking, but I wanted to recognize them. Great Greg Troutwine from the Moorhead Office of Northwest Legal Services, Bob Friday from the Virginia Office of Legal Aid of Northeastern Minnesota, Christy Snow-Caster from Central Minnesota Legal Services, and Floyd Panuski from Anoka Judicare. And with me at the table is Laura Jelnick from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. I would ask permission that Laura tell you a client story very, very quickly. We're mindful of your time. We want you not only to make the session, but be able to grab a bite to eat. So I will address the chair's question as soon as Laura has an opportunity, if that is with your permission.
You bet. Go ahead. With your name and title. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Jelinek. I'm an attorney at Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. And quickly, an example of a case that we do, a client came to our Mankato office, a disabled man who had been locked out of his apartment. He asked us to help him to enforce his rights under the tenant laws to get back in. We investigated the case. We evaluated. We determined that the landlord had illegally locked him out. The landlord came back and said, it's a hotel, he doesn't have any rights. Our lawyer went to court on behalf of the man. The court agreed and ordered the homeless man back in his apartment, only to have the case appealed to the Court of Appeals. Our lawyer again represented the disabled man, and the Court of Appeals agreed that it wasn't a hotel. He had paid a damage deposit, he had paid rent, he had signed a lease, and that the owner in this case couldn't circumvent the landlord-tenant laws to illegally get someone out of their apartment. It just is an example of helping folks prevent homelessness and to enforce their rights under the laws that we have.
Okay. Go ahead again.
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
The basis for our request, which is an increase in funding of $1.032 million over our current appropriation, is to expand our service capacity to serve more people. And it would take us back to our 2008 funding level. In 2008 and even in 2010, we were able to serve as a statewide network closer to 52,000 individuals and families across the state. We have offices across the state, and we serve people in all 87 counties to help meet their most basic human needs for safety, shelter, and sustenance. With the recession, we had considerable decreased funding, and as of 2013, which is the last year the Supreme Court has statewide data for us, we were serving 48,000 families and individuals across the state. We want to increase our capacity to serve more people and to leverage the resources as we do to reach people through our technological innovations. We have a website we built and developed, improved continuously, called Law Help MN. It has dozens of low literacy legal fact sheets on it and other resources so that anyone from the public can access some information to meet their needs, because there's so many people we need to turn away. We also leverage the resources by bringing in federal grants to do our work. Most, if not all, of the federal grants, not quite all, but most of the federal grants we all apply for do require a match, and that match is often met through the state money. In addition, I wanted to point out the justice gap. We'd like to inch towards closing it. We've done three unable to serve studies over the past several years. We did the first one in 2009, where we measured how many people who qualify for our services by income eligibility and the type of legal problem we actually help with, which, as you know, is not everything. It's just safety, shelter, and sustenance. We were turning away in 2009 one out of every two eligible callers. By 2012, we were turning away two out of every three eligible callers, only serving one of every three. And unfortunately, in 2014, when we redid the survey, we were still only serving one out of three, turning away two out of three. So our request is for your support to inch towards closing that justice gap, to be able to serve more people. It won't close the justice gap entirely, obviously, but it would get us back to our 2008 funding level from the state. We do the materials, if you go through them, we will seek funding from every source we can, but the state appropriation is obviously a critical part of our funding. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions you might have. If I might say one thing, we are a line item in the court's budget, as I think you know. The court has supported our request. We work closely with the court. Our law help website is a link on their prominent link on their self-help website. And we've had a lot of conversations with them about the fact that having an attorney for a meritorious case, as in the client that Laura talked about, really makes the courts move more quickly. Without legal services, that man either would have been homeless or he might have wound his way through the system pro se, but I think we all know how well that works for everybody, the courts and other people who are trying to access them. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hilford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but I just want to say one of the areas that I've noticed that there's been an increase in services is in the area of financial exploitation. So members, in the criminal side, when someone steals the money from the senior, you know, we can prosecute them. But if they've transferred title or property into someone else's name, that we heard with Representative Norton, someone, you know, bought assets and resources, it's really the legal aid type lawyer who can help with those kinds of things. And so I think you've seen an increase in those kinds of cases as well. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, indeed we have. In fact, for a year in my organization, we were actually fortunate enough to have an attorney be able to dedicate to that work and really set up some things in place so that we can do that work more effectively. For people with seniors and people with disabilities, this is a serious, serious problem. And throughout the state, we work hard to address it. Thank you.
So on this extra money that's requested, what about salaries, FTEs, raises, anything like that? Or is it is just a big pot that you, or is it just for expansion of services to more people?
Mr. Chair and members, we are, as you know, a network of quite a large number of nonprofit organizations and not a state agency. So each nonprofit who gets this money that is granted through the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has a grant-making process for this, this state appropriation. I can't guarantee that there wouldn't be some salary improvement, although our salaries are the lowest for lawyers pretty much. It's certainly in any kind of system. We aren't even at three-quarters of the public defender salary. But on the other hand, our commitment is to improve service capacity. That is why we want this money. We want to be able to help more people. It is the hardest thing that my staff has to do is to say no to someone who is unsafe or facing homelessness in unrepaired housing, has a relative being financially exploited, has a disabled child that can't get services. To say no to these people is the hardest thing we do every single day. So it is our commitment to you that that we will use the money to increase service capacity to the maximum degree possible.
I didn't mean to infer that you are restricted from spending it on anything else. I just wanted.
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to infer that you were restricted on spending it for these other things. I just wanted the tracking of it. So, any other questions? Okay, Representative.
Mr. Chair, this seems like a really, really good investment to the state. I think equal representation is something that people without means often struggle with, and this is one opportunity to allow that to happen. So I want to thank you for coming and asking for the added request. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
And with that, meeting adjourned.